Welcome to Get Over It, the Intuitive Transformation Podcast for Exceptional 21st Century Living. We've got a very interesting show today. We're going to be talking about teens and suicide and depression. We're going to be speaking with Christy Hugstad, and she's the author of Beneath the Surface, A Teen's Guide to Reaching Out When You or Your Friend is in Crisis. And folks, you know, in today's world, unfortunately, this is a hot topic, and it's a topic that everyone needs to wrap their mind around, so to speak, so that we can heal not only the young people, but we can heal ourselves. Now, the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you break through blocks and release energy that is no longer needed. Yes, we're going to help you break through and release your BS that is holding you back. But you know, I always ask the question, are you truly ready to? And by the way, folks, BS is belief system. A bit about me for my new listeners, intuitive since birth. I'm a third generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience helping people break through the blocks along their path. I'm a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing information which enables you to become a master builder of your life. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I am the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I authored Getting Your M&Ms, The Men and Money Book, and Masterful Choices, The Key to Easy, Effective Change. I provide consultations and healings regarding relationships, business, career, money, and love that heal the mind-body-spirit connection, allowing you to live your life, again, to the fullest. Now, my clients tell me that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living a human existence, but they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist, so whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. To find out more about me and the services I offer, go to my website, and that's MoniqueChapman.com, and I invite you to like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. Christy says, teens today experience some complex issues, all of which may be caused by or may contribute to depression and other mental illnesses. This book offers information on eating disorders, anxiety, substance abuse, self-harm, bullying, technology addiction, peer and academic pressures, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Christy Hugstad is the author of Beneath the Surface, A Teen's Guide to Reaching Out When You or Your Friend is in Crisis, and What I Wish I Had Known, which addresses her husband's suicide. A certified grief recovery specialist and grief and loss facilitator for recovering addicts at the South Coast Behavioral Health Center, Christy frequently speaks at high schools, educating the teens. She is also the host of the Grief Girl podcast, and she lives in Orange County, California, and you can check her out online at thegriefgirl.com. Again, that's thegriefgirl.com. Welcome, Christy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, it's great to have you here. We're going to talk about teens, but I want to kind of set the tone by first talking about your husband and his suicide, because I think that's kind of what launched you into this work. So could you give us a brief overview of what happened? And
Certainly. 7 years ago, my husband ran in front of a train in Dana Point, California, where we live. And to make it even a little more traumatic, his father was a passenger on that train.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. But that just kind of gives your listeners the scope of how deep his depression was, you know, that his father, a man that he admired and loved, was actually a passenger. So that's how sick he was.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, he had been distributing of depression and mental illness, and all the warning signs of suicide were there. It's just I didn't understand how significant they were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I tried to fix him. I wanted him to go back to the person that I had married. And so I took to psychiatrists, psychologists, healers, church counselors, trying to find that magic person or that magic pill that would back to the man that I married. And so after his death, I thought, you know, I can either be a victim of my tragedy and continue to spiral into depression myself, or I can take that pain and I can do something with it to educate other people so nobody else has to experience what I have been through. Mm-hmm. So that was my initial path, but my biggest mission is to abolish the stigma of mental illness, because my husband didn't reach out and say, you know what, I have major depression, I need help. You know, he wasn't brought up that way. He was brought up as a young boy that it's not okay to show emotion or to cry or to say something's wrong. You know, he was brought up just, you know, suck it up. You're a boy. You know.
Well, but not only that, Chrissy, in the book you talk about your husband being like the star quarterback, and he had the looks and everything to go along with that package that we expect these days. So wasn't it like impossible for him to admit that, you know, there was any deficiency?
Well, yeah. I mean, when he was a star athlete, he was very popular with girls, the best dressed. I mean, from the outside, I would think that his peers and classmates thought he had everything. But my point is that depression and mental illness doesn't discriminate. So from the outside, he may have looked like he had everything at his fingertips, but he didn't. And the same thing happened as we grew older and throughout our marriage. I think people looked up to him as a business owner. We were successful. Now we had a great home. So it's very deceiving. You know, you don't think people like that have any reason to be depressed.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, depression is a disease, and it can happen to anyone.
Yeah, it can. So let's start off by talking about the brain itself. You say in the book that the brain, for younger people, it really doesn't mature until between ages 25 to 30. And even at that, it seems to mature from the back of the brain, the reptilian brain, going toward the front. So talk to us about that and why that's so important to understand when we're yelling at our 22-year-old about not having their life together.
Well, the brain development is so significant because that prefrontal cortex, that front part of your brain, that's the last to develop. But that part of your brain is responsible for the decision-making, you know, the reasonable decisions and controlling impulsivity. So when that part of your brain is not developed, you're going to act first and maybe think later. And that impulsivity is what is so scary, because when teens are in crisis or they're being bullied or they're not being treated by their peers and they feel tormented, life is over, they are more apt to act on impulse. And suicide can be an act of impulsivity, of acting on impulse. So we sometimes as adults need to serve as their prefrontal cortex. And I put that chapter in the book because I think it's also important for teens to realize and understand about their own brain development so they don't think that their parents or teachers or adults in their lives that love them are just nagging. You know, they do have a fully developed brain, and they are thinking for you as to what could the consequences be of this decision.
Well, not only that, we're putting pressure on, you know, our 9th, 10th, 11th graders, because you have to get the right grades to get into the right schools. You got to make that decision about what your major is going to be. And it's almost impossible for them to do that when they don't have the brain power, if you will, to get that done.
Well, exactly. And they're not as capable of multitasking and, you know, thinking down the line and getting organized. You know, that's why their room is a mess, because they're doing one thing at a time. They're studying. And as a parent, you can think, well, why can't you take 10 minutes and clean up your room? Why can't you multitask? But I think we need to back off and take away some of that parental pressure for the academic and let them develop and support them in being who they are rather than trying to mold them into somebody that you want them to be. So the parental pressure is huge because most kids really want to please their parents. They don't want to be a disappointment. And that, that additional pressure, you know, on top of self-pressure can sometimes be very overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say in your book that in the United States, 15 million kids have parents who are depressed. So if the parent themselves are depressed and they're trying to, I don't know, guide their child down a path for a better life, but they're depressed, how is it that the child can overcome or rise above depression? Because that's what they're brought up in. They're in a depression soup, so to speak.
Well, and their parents are their role models. And if their parents aren't owning their own depression and reaching out and getting help, then, you know, then their children are going to also buy into the stigma that it's not okay to have a mental illness. So by the parents not getting help themselves, they are sending the message to their kids. And that message is just suck it up. Don't own it. Just out, give living to it and do the best you can. And that is not okay because then the stigma continues and the stigma keeps getting worse. And that needs to be changed. That's why beneath the surface for me, I knew I had, in order to change our culture and get rid of that stigma, it has to start young. That our kids grow up in a culture where their mental health is just as important as their physical health. And they won't think twice about reaching out for help because they are struggling emotionally. So that I started with the teens. I want our youth to grow up differently than we did. Because I think some people in their 50s, 60s, they've had 40 years of buying into the stigma, and it's really hard to change their mentality.
Okay. So to get to the point where we can truly have no stigma around mental health, you know, not just for the teenagers or even adolescents, but for the adults, what steps do we need to take, you know, locally and even nationally to erase the stigma? Because if you say, certain parts of the country, it's okay. Like, you know, California, it's like, oh, I got a therapist. Everybody's like, yeah, well, I've got three, so what? But then other parts of the country, and you'll say, I have a therapist, and people are, eyes get wide, and they start backing away from you. How can we
everyone? And you know what? You're absolutely right, because in rural parts of our country, they don't have adequate mental health services. You know, they might have to drive 90 minutes, 2 hours to even find a therapist. So it does vary, you know, in different regions throughout the country. But I think the first step is that we have to understand illness, that they're diseases, just like cancer, diabetes. You know, if you're diagnosed with cancer, you would not go lay in your bed and pull the covers over your head and hope that you feel better in the next few days.
Right.
You would immediately figure out who is the medical professional I need to see for my cancer and begin treatment immediately. And once you know that there is treatment, that breeds hope. And with that hope of getting better, you start feel better, and that helps depression. If we also look at mental illnesses in the same light, there is treatment. We need to reach out and seek a mental health professional, and by doing that, that will feel joy once again. So the first education about what mental illnesses really are, they're not something that you choose. You know, nobody chooses to have major depressive disorder. And so we need to educate everybody so that we're all on the same page and we treat depression and mental illnesses as the diseases that they are.
Okay. So following on with that, what is depression? What are the symptoms of depression?
Well, it's not just normal sadness, because we all as humans experience that from time to time. So depression is diagnosed typically when that sadness doesn't live for 2 to 3 weeks or longer. And what starts to happen is that you feel that sadness and that overwhelming heaviness even when things are right. So it becomes a permanent state of mind. And over time, it gets worse. So if you see that happening to a loved one or a child, don't think, oh, part of being here, or, you know what, my husband's going through some stuff right now, but it never seems to pass.
Talked about the symptoms of depression. The one thing that struck out to me in your book, I think it might add to depression, is young folks suffering from gender confusion and social uncertainty. Talk to us about that.
Well, it's really hard for anybody, and especially our teens, when they feel like they don't fit in because they're not sure, or they feel not accepted, or they don't feel comfortable with themselves, they are at a higher risk for suicide because they're not fitting into society, and they may be not fitting in with their peers. So let's take, for example, somebody that's transgender. They are nine times more at risk for suicide. Or someone from the LGBTQ community is five times at a higher risk for suicide because of the uncertainty, the confusion. And as we all remember, when you're a teen, really the most important thing in your life is fitting in and being accepted by your peers. Yes. And if you're struggling with accepting who you are certainly not going to probably be accepted by your peers, because you may be pretending to be somebody that you're not. So that's a huge issue for teens.
Yeah. And you actually drive that point home in the book. Share a story, I can't remember the young lady's name, but her mom was, you know, beautiful and, you know, all dolly and everything, and dad kind of wasn't there for her, and she was having these issues, and she didn't know what to do. And then, folks, there are many stories in the book that drive home the point of each subject that she's speaking to. So for whatever reason you don't grasp it, you can give the book to your kid. The kid can sit and read it and get it. They can identify with someone probably right in their classroom who is going through what we've been talking about. Folks, we're speaking with Christy Hugstead. She's the author of Beneath the Surface, A Teen's Guide to Reaching Out When You or Your Friend is in Crisis. It's available everywhere. And then you can go to her website and check her out. And that is the griefgirl.com. Again, her website, thegriefgirl.com. Christy, I want to talk to you about substance abuse right now. You know, we've got pot that's legalized here in California and other places throughout the country. Kids are still, you know, drinking alcohol underage. They're smoking cigarettes. And now vaping is a great big deal. How does the abuse of substances play into the depression and possible suicides?
Well, when young people are numb and they're feeling depressed, and of course, being a teen, that's probably the time when your self-esteem is at its lowest. If you have other issues on top of that, if you're feeling parental pressure, if you're being bullied or cyberbullied, you're not fitting in with your peers, the typical teen reaction is, I need to find something to help me numb that pain and make me feel better. Mm-hmm. And so it's a natural progression then to think, well, maybe alcohol will give me some relief. And if that doesn't do it, you know, maybe their peer will introduce them to drugs. or vaping, or, you know, anything that helps numb the emotional pain, because they are looking for relief. And I work with addicts in recovery, and, you know, I do grief work. And one of my objectives is, what caused you to start using? Tell me how old you were and what you were thinking. Let's get to the root of this. The majority of them said that they started at age 13. They started with alcohol. They started with cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And when they and then that really became kind of, you know, old hat. And then they were introduced to meth or heroin. And, you know, from there it went to fentanyl. So, and this all happened probably before they were 18. So, you know, they start by just experimenting, and then their peers are introducing them to other possibilities. And in their little brains, and like I discussed earlier, how their brains are not fully developed and their decision-making is often lacking, mm-hmm. they're not going to think, hey, if I try this meth, maybe it'll be laced with fentanyl and I'll overdose or I'll die. That's not how their brain works. They are thinking for the relief at the moment, and if there's a possibility that experimenting with drugs or alcohol can provide some relief, that is where their heads are at. They just want relief.
Mm-hmm. That is a truly sad statement on our society in general, that our children are so stressed.
I mean, you talk about teens being more stressed than most adults. For many reasons, whether it's peer pressure or depression or self-esteem issues or whatever, but it's really sad state of affairs that our children are basically losing themselves.
Well, yes, and when you think about, you know, when I think back to me being in the ninth grade, I was bullied, and I remember that, you know, really well. Mm-hmm. But at least when I got home from school, I had a safe place at home, mm-hmm. because there were no iPhones, right? So nobody was going to go on Instagram and say something horrible about me, or Snapchat. But now when kids leave school, the cyberbullying actually makes things worse, because mm-hmm. the person you may least expect that would be a bully is now anonymous and can go online and be whoever they choose to be. And so the hard thing for teens now is they have no safe place. They are connected to their peers 24/7. And if they are being bullied, they can't escape it. And when they get home from school and away from their peers, sometimes it even is worse for them because of technology. So they are growing up in a completely different world than we did. And I think sometimes as parents, that's hard to understand, you know, and the parents will say things, well, when I was your age, you know, whatever it was, and that just doesn't help, because that minimizes what they're going through.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I recently worked with a family, and actually the kid was in the early 20s. He wasn't even a teen anymore, but he was bullied in high school, and his mom made him be friends with the guy that was bullying him. And you know, I guess the mother just didn't understand or wouldn't believe that this guy was bullying her kid, although everybody else around her was seeing it and telling her. So what do you do with a parent that's like that? They just refuse to believe, whether it's, you know, their insecurity or some other insecurity that, you know, their child is actually going through this.
Well, I think the parents kind of need to take a step back and look at how they are parenting, because a good parenting skills would lead you to have your child's best interest at heart, have lines of communication open, and do what is best and be supportive of your child, not do what you would like them to do, ignore the fact that they're being tortured at school by their peers. You know, that's absolutely devastating. And to not acknowledge that is the worst thing you can do, because then your child feels like they don't even have the support of their own parents. And to me, there's nothing worse than that, because they look to their parents for that moral support, and just they need to know that somebody is in their court and they're not alone in it. They matter. And if the parents are minimizing it and saying, go be best friends with that person, you know, it's hard for me to even comment because they are so not in touch with what's going on in their world today.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the parent even going through working with me and therapists, they just don't want to grasp the fact that, you know, they have some play in that. It's really sad. But there's another instance I want to talk about. And actually, I had a kid that went through this, and he's severely dyslexic. Still is. He's a high school teacher, but he's still severely dyslexic. And through high school, I mean, he went to a gate-oriented school because the area that we lived in, the whole school system was gate oriented. So, you know, you talk about many fights with the school system and the principal. But, you know, with the dyslexia, kids made fun of him. And he was a chubby kid, so he got that type of teasing. He was the only black kid in the school, so he got that type of teasing. And that led to depression, panic attacks, and all kinds of negative issues. So talk to us about learning disabilities and how that can affect us, our kids, especially with anxiety.
Well, you know, that is something that needs to be addressed very, very young, because all our kids know is that if somebody is different, and it doesn't matter how, whether they're dyslexic or they have a learning disability, whatever it is about that their peer that makes them different, In a teen's brain, that's cause for exclusion and bullying, mm-hmm. right? So here's an example. What if we lived in a world, and I'm going to use my two nieces as an example. They're kindergarten teachers. Mm-hmm. They are teaching kindness, acceptance, and inclusion at age 5. Wonderful. So if they ever see anybody that is on the playground and they're alone or they look sad, the other children have learned that's bad and that's sad and you need to help. So they will go up to them and include them, and everybody is the same. And they're teaching kindness and acceptance and inclusion in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Now, that technique was passed on to every grade level. By the time our kids are in junior high, they will have been taught that it is not okay to treat your peers unkindly. And you think that's such a simple thing that we all should just, it's innate in our brains to be kind to one another. But I mean, there's adult bullying going on. Mm-hmm. I never learned anything about how to treat my classmates ever in high school, junior high, elementary school. That was never discussed. But, you know, since kids' brains are slow to develop and it's a long, long process, parents and teachers and adults need to teach them that everybody is equal and teach kids to love and be kind and accepting. And that's not happening. So I think there are changes, and I think it's happening slowly. But unfortunately, just for example, like the child that you were describing, that really concerns me because his self-esteem has to be zero. Mm-hmm. He has to feel so bad about himself. And mm-hmm. since he has that teen brain and he's more prone to act impulsively, to me, he would be at a high risk for suicide. And that is just so, so tragic.
Yeah. He is actually, and the mother told him to get over it.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. So I'm like,
that is
okay.
The worst. I don't even know what to say to that.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it because I was watching it happen. I was like, hey. Okay, so we've talked about all these things that kids go through. Could you share with us some ways to deal with pressure and stress, that the teens can deal with pressure and stress? Does the concept of having a safe person to go to talk to really help, or is that just a facade?
Absolutely. And, you know, in my book, and when I go to junior high and high schools and I talk to kids about the issues that they're going through, the main thing that I stress is that, you know what, you be a heart with ears to your peers, right? And you listen, and because listening is the power tool that restores hope for all of us. So mm-hmm. being a good listener, offering support, like I'm going to be here for you, you know, I have your back, that kind of thing. That's all really important. But if you have a friend or a sibling or somebody in your life that says, you know, I really have a plan and I don't want to be here anymore, but please don't say anything because I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want to disappoint my parents. That's not the time to keep that secret. So the main message I give in the book is if it's you that is experiencing suicidal thoughts, if you don't want to be here, if you are not in a good place, please tell an adult you trust immediately. Don't think it's going to pass on its own. And if a friend or a family member swears you to secrecy, that's not the time to keep that secret, because you, by telling somebody that you trust, could save their life. And it doesn't have to be your parents. It could be the school counselor. It could be your aunt, your uncle. It could be somebody at your church. So you know, like when I go to schools, that safe person that they trust is me, because I'm none of those things. I'm just somebody that cares. So I think it's important for all of us to build a safety net around each other and be there for support. And then when necessary, get that individual the help that they need.
Okay. Now, in the book, you talk about PTSD, and you say that girls are more prone to have this condition. So what are the causes, and can you ever get past it?
Well, absolutely. But what happens is this is happening over a period of time. And there again, you know, it's not something that is probably just going to go away on its own. And it can be one situational incident, like moving or having your parents go through a divorce or breakup of a relationship. So there can be one traumatic life event that is triggering. And so I think parents need to realize, you know, the divorce or the fighting at home, or you moved and your child's had to change school, or somebody in your family's gone to jail, or whatever that traumatic event is, that has more of an impact on your child than you think. And you need to keep the lines of communication open so that they have somebody that they trust and they can start processing what has happened. Because keeping it inside is the worst thing they can do. And you know what? As I mentioned earlier, your kids don't want to disappoint you, right? So if you're getting a divorce and one of you is moving out, your kids need to be in that loop and you need to discuss it with them.
Okay. You touched on earlier technology, I'll get that out, addiction. Whether it's cell phone or, you know, whatever gadget they're playing, how can we help our young folks get past the addiction but still be a part of what's going on? I mean, I've seen kids that will sit in front of their Game Boy or whatever, you know, the game is these days, 10, 12 hours a day. I have parents calling me. I can't get them off of it. I take it away, and they go find it, and they plug it back in. So what can we do to help these kids get past this? Because there's more to life. I even sit in my home office. The dads and the millennial dads are walking down the street pushing the baby carriage, but they're on the phone not paying attention to what's going on in the street.
Well, you're absolutely right. We are not the best role models for, you know, technology addiction, because you are right. I see families where everybody's sitting around the table on their phones. Parents included. Mm-hmm. So I think the important thing is you have to recognize it and curb it and dial it back before it becomes an addiction. And once it's an addiction, it's really, really tough to dial it back, because that addiction is raising the dopamine level in your child's brain. And that's why they continue to spend more and more time online and using technology to get that same sense of euphoria that the dopamine, that feel-good chemical in your brain, is producing by being online. So some of the warning signs to look for before they become addicted is they start neglecting their family and friends. Mm-hmm. They go to bed and you think they're sleeping, but you check in on them 4 in the morning and they're on their phones or they're on their computers.
Mm-hmm.
They lie about their usage. Oh, no, no, no. You know, I slept all night. They feel anxious, ashamed, guilty, or depressed as a result of their excessive technology use. They start not wanting to go to things that they used to enjoy. So, you know, even things like there's this thing called phantom vibration where they keep checking their phones because they think their phone is vibrating and then they pull it in their pocket and it's not. That's how serious the addiction is. I have had mothers that have come in to talk to me about their kids, and if they take the technology away, they start crying and throwing a fit. The younger ones start screaming and throwing tantrums. So that is a really tough thing to do, to dial it back once it has become such an addiction. And I think it's important for parents to realize it is a chemical change in their brain. It's not their choice, right? The dopamine level is that feel-good chemical that is driving that obsessiveness and that need to be on technology. So that, you know, that needs to be caught and addressed before it gets that out of control.
Would anything like having family dinners together or even going out to dinner as a family unit and actually talking to each other help?
Yes, absolutely. And, it, you know, I mean, it's funny that we even have to bring that up. That should just be a given. But start dialing back your kids gradually, just like any other addiction. You wean them off in small increments. Mm-hmm. You do not have phones or technology after a certain hour or during mealtime. So, you know, kids really do want a sense of community and a strong family unit.
Mm-hmm.
But if left to their own choice, they're going to pick technology over their family. You know, so you need to make that choice for them. And they do want that sense of community and family. So start dialing back the technology gradually and get it back in control.
Okay. Now, Krista, you have this wonderful podcast. Tell us more about that.
Well, the Grief Girl podcast, I address all different kinds of grief because I want listeners to know that grief is not just about death. You know, there are over 40 different kinds of losses that we deal with, the loss of trust, faith, relationships, loss of community, safety. So I have different guests on, you know, a loss of addiction. People might not think that that's a loss. But I'll have guests that were, you know, once a heroin addict on the streets and how they changed their lives and what they missed about that. So it's real life losses, and it's mainly focusing on different types of grief other than just death.
Okay. And when they go to your website, thegriefgirl.com, what are they going to find in addition to the first book that you wrote was What I Wish I'd Known, plus the podcast?
All my blogs for the Huffington Post and the Elephant Journal, my speaking engagements, if they want me to come to their school or organization, there is a form to fill out, which I will get directly and get right back to you. All of my blogs, and so everything, all of my work, my story, the books are also available on my website, so pretty much I keep it up to date, you know, weekly.
Okay. And folks, do check out the book. If you have a teenager, if you have a preteen, get the book. It's a simple read. It's a very easy read, you know. It should take you a couple hours, you know, if you're a moderate reader. And start utilizing some of the techniques. Share with other parents. It's really important, especially in this day and age, that we save our children. They have so much going on between their world and then watching the adults act extremely interesting in our world right now that they need something that they can hold on. So please, please, please do your children a service and consider getting the book. Christine, the book, you say that it's possible to develop hope even if we feel completely hopeless. How do we do that?
Well, it's important to realize that what you're going through is temporary. And with the proper help and the proper treatment, you will develop the hope that you will once again experience joy. So if you are, if your listeners out there are feeling hopeless, or, you know, they don't, you're not feeling like your life is going to get better, please reach out. Find somebody that can give you appropriate treatment, help you process what you're going through, and give you that hope for a brighter future.
There you go. Folks, we've been speaking with Christy Hugstead. The book is Beneath
the Surface, A Teen's Guide to Reaching Out When You or Your Friend is in Crisis. This is a very important book for mankind. Again, it's an easy read. It's easy to understand, and the techniques are very easy to implement. Let's take some time and save our kids, because if we save our kids, we save the planet. So all of those who want to change the world, this is a great way to do it. And you know what? If you don't have a teenager and you have a niece or a nephew, get the book. Okay. It's definitely going to help you. And you know, if nothing else, folks, it's going to help open up the channel of communication, which is very important. So, Christy, I thank you for your time today. You've brought a valuable service to Get Over It.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And to the audience, I thank you for joining us. The Divine in Me honors the Divine in You. I truly am honored and appreciate everyone's time and attention. And when you're ready to raise your vibration and shift your energy, you can give me a call. Intuitive consultations, 30 minutes or longer, are offered at a 10% discount if you mention the podcast. Love yourself enough to make an investment in yourself and make that call, 888-240-6057. And remember, the most important choice that you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the masterful choice of helping a teen. Abundant blessings, light, and love to all. Namaste.